copies, thanks to the PTAs. That's very much. And we want to also keep in mind that our legislators can't eat all those cookies, drink all that coffee. We'd put on too much weight. So as you, through the evening, if you want a cup of coffee or cookies, we surely want the audience to feel free to get up and get some refreshments as well. The janitor today was Wayne Lessman, I think. Thanks for the setting up this facility. As I related to some people, I was on the way in today and had the radio on, and I heard on the radio that Pilot Knob was going to be closed today. And I thought, oh no, because of the water break. But we got it solved in time this morning to not have to cancel the meeting. We would ask that you do sign in if you want to testify. And we're also thankful for the Superintendent Jade Haugen to be here as well tonight. There are a couple of other announcements. The principal of Pilot Knob, Brian Schwab. Brian, are you there, standing in the back? Thanks very much for allowing the committee to be here this evening. And thanks for your staff to put this extra work in for us. We believe it's extremely important that we obtain input from all kinds of what we would call average citizens, not that we're average citizens as well, because we are. But it's important for us as we look at the major emphasis on the state budget that we obtain views from all parts of the state. We're here tonight to listen to your concerns and suggestions. We have some panels set up in different areas such as ECFE and K-12 and higher education and so forth. But if someone in the audience wants to talk about something different than that, we sure welcome your input as well. We also have provided you some green cards and some yellow cards in the staff. These green cards and yellow cards look like this. If at some point you want to ask a question and you don't feel like you want to get up and ask us or you want to make a comment, please feel free to fill one of these out and give it to the staff. And we'll either get it asked tonight. If we don't get it answered tonight, I'm sorry, then we will try our best to respond to you. And there's another card as well that's available for a staff person leave tonight if you want to have some additional input on some of the issues that we're facing in the state legislature. We want to, first of all, introduce ourselves. We're going to do that very quickly. My name is Representative Lawrence Solberg. I chair the Ways and Means Committee. My district is District 3B, encompasses Aiken County and parts of Itasca County. I live in Grand Rapids, and we're here tonight kind of for a special reason. I have two grandchildren that go to this school, so that's why I get to pick the school. So that's why we're here. But let's stop way down at the other end, and you're going to have to pass the mic because we don't have a handheld mic tonight. So if you can do that.
Thank you. My name is Matt Dean. I represent cities in northern Washington County. I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight on a cold night and look forward to hearing your comments on our priorities for school spending.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Eric Paulson, and I represent the Eden Prairie area, and pleasure to be here tonight.
Thank you for having us here. Steve Swigum, my farm about 45 miles to the south where we're sitting right now.
Good evening. I'm Mary Liz Holberg. I represent most of Lakeville.
I'm Danny McNamara. I'm a landscape contractor over in Hastings, and I'm also their legislator.
I'm Lynn Wardlow, and thanks for being here. I represent 38B, which is on the other side of Pilot Knob, and I'm a retired teacher.
I'm Lyndon Carlson, and I represent District 45B, which is in the northwest suburbs. That would be the communities of Robbinsdale, Crystal, Golden Valley, and part of New Hope.
I'm Phyllis Kahn. My district is in Minneapolis, right around the University of Minnesota.
I'm Sandy Mason, and I represent 38A, and this school is in 38A, so I'm definitely glad to see all of you. And actually, my two older children did attend Pilot Knob at one point.
I'm going to skip a couple people. They'll come back.
Good evening. I'm Margaret Anderson Kelleher. I represent District of Minneapolis, half of downtown in the west side of the city, and I also serve as the Speaker of the Minnesota House. Thanks for having us.
I'm Shelley Madure. Apple Valley 196 is my primary school district. I see my superintendent there and board member, so I'm very excited to be here tonight. Thank you for inviting us.
I'm Ron Earhart. I represent most of the city of Edina. It's nice to be here tonight. Nice to see the smiling faces, but no pink cheeks. Have you people been out tonight or not?
I'm Senator Jim Carlson, and I represent District 38, which is Burnsville and Eagan, and we are in Senate District 38. It ends out at the street there, so the other side is not Senate District 38.
I'm Representative Kent Eakin. I represent District 2A up in northwest Minnesota. The east side is Lake Itasca and Itasca State Park all the way over to the Red River Valley.
Hi, I'm Kathy Reinert from Mankato, and I'm really glad to be. I'm a freshman legislator, and I come from about 20 years of involvement in education, including 11 years as a school board member. So I feel very comfortable being back in a school. I love the positive messages and the energy that the presence of children brings, even when they're not in the building. So thanks for welcoming us.
I'm Bill Hilke. I represent District 8A, which is substantial portions of Pine and Carlton counties and a little bit of St. Louis County, cities of Cloquet, Carlton, Moose Lake, that area.
Hi, I'm Representative Marcia Swales. I'm from Woodbury and Landfall, and I began my teaching career back in the mid-1970s in the school district at Francis M. Grass Junior High. So I have a lot of good memories of District 197.
Hey, I am Representative Erin Murphy from 64A in St. Paul. And in addition to being a registered nurse, I'm also a parent of 15-year-old twin daughters.
Hi, I'm Nora Slawick, and I represent Oakdale and Southern Maplewood, and I am here tonight as the chair of the Early Childhood Finance Committee, so I'm looking forward to your testimony on early childhood.
Good evening. I'm Ann Lentusky. I live about 10 miles from here, so nice to be close to home tonight on a cold night. I represent Bloomington.
Did we get everybody down there?
I'm Kathy Novak. I'm with the House Research Department and staff to the Ways and Means Committee.
I'm Greg Crowe in the Fiscal Analysis Department, and I cover K through 12 education issues.
Okay, just a couple of other things. One, for the members up here, these mics are on live all the time. So if you're having some conversation off to the side, can you make sure that for the tape purposes that the mic is far enough away so it doesn't pick it up? And then I guess when we talk, we have to talk into the mic as well. The same thing is true, I guess, for the people that are testifying before us. To start out a particular hearing, sometimes it's good to have just a couple of minutes of some knowledge of where we start our budgeting process. And we always start the saying is that the governor proposes and the legislature's role is to dispose. In other words, we start with the basis of the governor's budget. And before we start, can I introduce my grandkids? Can they come in the door? Okay, my granddaughter and my grandchildren, Austin, Carter, and Brooke. They're the ones. And Austin was his basketball coach last year was former Representative Tim Wilkin. So did you win any games? Oh, okay. That's great. Okay, before we start today, I would like to have then Greg Crowe just give us a 2-3 minutes of what's happening from where we start from in the governor's budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If you look, you have a handout in your packet called Governor's Budget Recommendations, the overall budget here. I'll just skim through a couple of items in there. We're all pretty familiar with the November forecast that indicated about a $2 billion budget surplus composed of about $1 billion of one-time carry-forward money from 06, 07, and $1 billion of new ongoing surplus funding beginning in 08, 09. You see those figures in the first three paragraphs on page one. The third paragraph highlights the governor's recommendations for the 2008-2009 biennium. Basically, the governor's budget proposes spending the bulk of this money, about $1.953 billion, over the 2008-2009 base, which is a 6% increase compared to base. If you look at the chart on page 2, you'll see that the balance after reserves for fiscal 2008-2009 under the governor's recommendation is about $10 million, indicating that the entire $2 billion is projected to be expended under the governor's proposals. You see in fiscal 2010-11 a balance after reserves of about $1 billion for the out years for the governor's proposed budget. If inflation, planning estimate inflation was included, the inflation would amount to about $957 million, leaving a balance after reserves of about $100 million. Then I'm just going to skip a few pages. If you look at page 5, I was asked to talk a little bit about the governor's education budget, so I'll focus on that. On page 5, the top of the table, you see that the governor proposed a budget recommendation for 2008-2009 of $13.5 billion. This is about $720 million over the base for 2008-2009, which is about a 7.5% increase compared to the prior year, or a 5.7% increase over the base. Two lines down, you can see the early childhood budget. The base is $420 million. There's actually a reduction from base because of about $73 million worth of TANF refinancing for child care that the governor includes in this budget in the early childhood area. There is one sizable increase in the budget of about $26 million for early childhood programs, as I mentioned in a minute. If you go to page 9, you'll see a summary of what's in the governor's budget for K-12 education. And I'll just highlight a couple of different items on that page. The first major initiative is approximately $300 million to provide 2% per year on the basic funding formula, and raising the formula from a little under $5,000 to just under $5,200 per pupil. Then there's $150 million allocated on a one-time basis for fiscals 2008 and 9 only for schools that achieve three-star ratings in either math or reading, on the math or reading tests. And that money is $75 million per year and is basically divided evenly among all schools that qualify for the money. So it's not, so the formula amount for that isn't specified. It could range between $90 and $150 per pupil, depending on how many pupils are in schools that qualify for that funding. And again, that is one-time money for 2008 to 2009. Then the third item is there's $40 million of annual property tax relief in the form of reductions to the operating capital levy. The fourth dash on the page is $75 million to fund three ARC high schools, which is the governor's proposal for allocating money to schools to add courses, college program, college level programs, personal graduation plans, and several other initiatives related to changing high schools. Then at the bottom of the page, you see $30 million for special education, and this is basically provided by adding a 2% growth factor to the special education formulas. And the top of the next page, $38 million is $19 million a year is in the governor's budget on a one-time basis for 2008 and 9 only to provide additional technology for school districts. And then I would also mention that the governor is proposing in the early childhood area, $26 million in starting in FY09 for kindergarten scholarship program that would provide scholarships to students to try and improve their school readiness for kindergarten.
Thank you. That's a quick snapshot of what the governor is proposing. And this particular document, if you do not have a copy of it, there's all kinds of them available, and we want you to take that with us, and it's good bedtime reading tonight, I'm sure. Before we start with some of the panels, the school board is meeting this evening. We have, I know, the superintendent and a school board member available. If they just kind of come up to the table and get some greetings from you. If there are other school board members that come in, we'll welcome them as well. That's great. Now, we do have the meeting tonight is being recorded, so if you can use the microphone, and I think that helps project as well out there. And so if you'd be kindness to identify yourself for the tape. We've got big panels, so we'll have to ask everybody to be brief. Thank you.
Kent Mogler, school board member, I'm on my second term, served for 7 years.
Jim Leslie, school board member, been on the school board for 1 year.
Jay Haugen, superintendent, 6 months already here. The superintendent, past superintendent in Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. I met some of you during that time.
And I'm Reen Schiffman. I am a resident of Mendota Heights, and this is also my first year, have completed my first year on the school board, and it's an absolutely fascinating experience, something that I never would have imagined prior to coming on the school board. It's interesting, when we were talking to different school boards before we hired Superintendent Haugen, school board members, one of the things that somebody commented to me was that prior to becoming a school board member herself, she thought there was only one way that education functioned, and that was her way. And what she's come to realize, having been on the school board now, is that there are two sides to everything, and that there's a lot that we know as school board members that the public is not always aware of. And so I am so pleased that you have joined us in our community tonight to become aware, to hear from the public about education, to allow us to discuss with you, and to allow the community to share their thoughts with you. I just want to start by saying that I have been working in the nonprofit industry for 30 years as a fundraiser and in marketing. In fact, I followed Representative Slawick in her position at United Way. And one thing that I've learned, I've worked for several causes, is there's nothing more important than education. Education is where it starts. It's the infrastructure of our society. And if we don't get it right, we're going to have some real issues coming down the road in the future. I thank you for the support that you provided to this for education funding last year. It was a great start. I will assure you that as school districts, and if I had members from every school district here, we would all tell you that we are lean and trim. And we are hurting, and we need more funding. I would ask just briefly that you consider, if you are going to have a mandate, that you fund those mandates, that you be very careful about requesting the funding come from property taxes. We, like many districts, heard loud and clear that people are not necessarily going to voluntarily pay more in property taxes through levy votes. So we need you to consider ways in which we can be more assured more of funding so that we can help our students from pre-K to college and also for those who want to continue learning even after they graduate. So thank you very much for your attention to this.
We also have been informed that there's another superintendent of District 196 in the college. Would you like to come up to the table and say something also? And again, we're going to ask you to be brief. Welcome to the committee, and if you can state your name for the tape, please.
John Curry, Superintendent of School District 196.
Kevin Sampers, Board Member 196.
Welcome to the committee. Do you have some testimony you'd like to give us, a brief statement? Okay, very good. Pass the microphone.
I will be brief and on to that, and as the board members around me can testify, that is a tall order. But we are proud to have you today. My overall thought on this, without spending time getting to specifics, is I want everyone to. I have a passion for education. That's the reason I'm superintendent for 11 years. Passion comes from a big idea of what education really can be. Education can solve so many, many of our society's ills. We have so many children who come to us from poverty, who come to us unready to learn, who come to us with English as a second language. The idea is to hook them into the American dream, to have them have every chance to success in life and to be positive contributors of society that any other child has. What I think we miss so often is how tall an order that is. How fast things have to happen in early childhood, for instance. How much of a race those few years are to set them on the path that will help them be successful. And that it does take resources, and it takes a lot of resources to get that done. And we see it every day. I'm working on a budget process for my school right now. I call it a transparent visual budget process, where we put in each school exactly the staffing and the support that goes to each school. And when it's all done, you can see that all of our money, virtually all of our money, goes to help educate students. That is how we spend our money. And as my board member Reen said, it is a tight thing to do when you have such a big vision, when you think you are doing something that can in a generation break the cycle of poverty and underachievement forever. When you have a vision that large, you know, any kind of scrimping and saving just seems like you're wasting time. So we do ask. I know we ask for a lot, but I think we want to give a lot. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. Any other brief remarks? You don't have to say anything if you don't want.
Well, I hadn't planned on doing this, but as long as I'm here. Many of you have gotten the legislative agenda for School District 196, Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan. You can basically summarize it very quickly. The first thing is concern for education across Minnesota. And you'll see a couple of projects referenced in there, PS Minnesota. I think some of you are familiar with that. And Minnesota's Promise. And that came from a group of superintendents that have been meeting for quite some time. I kind of summarize it sometimes when people ask me, if you remember the old Roadrunner cartoons, and it would show the coyote and the Roadrunner coming, and they'd come together, maybe on the same bus, and they'd punch in and fight all day long, and then at the end of the day, they'd punch out and go back home again and do the same thing over and over. And I feel sometimes we, as schools, say to you folks, we need more money, and we hear, you're always asking for more money, and we say, okay, We need it and know you've got too much, and we go through this every year, then we punch out and go back and come back again next year. The Minnesota Promise and PS Minnesota, I think, is a good faith effort to say it's time to stop that cycle and to look for some long-term solutions that would provide stability and some inflationary funding for schools, given what we now know it costs to educate a student in Minnesota to the standards that you've asked us to meet. And so that's the first part of our platform. The other three parts are inflationary spending or increases for our expenses. Special education is a concern for us. In District 196, our special education costs have doubled in the last 5 years, and we need to get a handle on that or we will be bankrupt. The other thing that's increased in that length of time is health care or health insurance. And those two factors alone are our biggest issues in our district. We're very fortunate. We've been able to pass a couple of levies most recently. We receive $1,042 in levy money in our district. And without it, it would be devastating for us. And you are going to probably hear tonight from other districts, our neighbors, who are attempting to do what's right for their kids and pass levies as well. And it's tough. It's very difficult to do that. And early childhood education, you're going to hear from some of our citizens tonight about that. So basically, it's an increase in funding, at least inflationary dollars. It's special education and it's early childhood. And more than anything else, let's have a common vision, a shared vision for what public education in Minnesota needs to look like.
Thank you. Thank you very much,
I'll take the opportunity as well. And
you can identify yourself.
I'm Kevin Sampers, and board member in District 196, and I've been on the board for about 13, 14 years now. And just want to backtrack a little bit and say I grew up in Eagan. My parents moved here in 1965, so went to the public schools all the way up through, came back and wanted to bring my family back and raise them in this district, partly because of the schools. And the way I think Minnesota is known nationally for education. Right now I have a daughter who is in college, one who's a junior, and one who's a freshman in high school. And the longer I've been on the school board, the more I've kind of gotten introspective and maybe a little bit philosophical about things. And, you know, every year, as John says, we get into this debate about money, but one of the things that I've really spent some time over the last year looking at is what are we trying to accomplish in public schools? And I think that we've spent a lot of time in the last few years talking about what isn't happening or trying to measure schools. And, you know, one of my pet peeves is with the No Child Left Behind legislation, use this example with some people, it'd be a little bit like putting in a relief pitcher and then walking out to them and saying, don't throw any balls. It's like we're assuming that things are negative and that we have to fix something. I think we would all do better in public officials in trying to portray to the state and to our society what we expect out of schools, what we want to unite behind and what we're trying to get out of our schools. When I think back to that, I grew up in an era when John F. Kennedy came out and said we're going to put a man on the moon in 10 years. And I'm sure all of you can kind of remember some of what happened, I think, in our education system during that time. Everybody got behind that. We really got into math and science and everything. I'm looking for what are we going to do in our public schools in this country to compete globally in the next 5 or 10 years. And I think we need to start having that dialogue and not so much just spend all of our time figuring out how much money we can put there, but what are we going to do? And I think if we can lay that out first, then we can have a discussion of what it costs to get there and how we're going to get there. So I'm going to lay that challenge on the table.
Thank you very much. Thanks to each of you. I know that 197 is a school board meeting tonight. Be going late. Thank you very much for coming. The next kind of panel that we're going to be talking about is with some testifiers on ECFE. Is it Yolanda Grant, Gina Ellison, I believe, Barb Walls, Dennis Demers, Ben Bussey, Tom Horton, if you could come up also, Miranda Benita, is that the correct pronunciation? And if I blew your name really bad, I apologize. Well, we have another rep that came in. Danny, want to identify yourself and where you're from?
Dennis Osman, Rosemont, Apple Valley.
pull up another chair. And again, we will take as much testimony as we can. We want you to be brief if you can. Get your message to us. There are some people also that in the audience that want to be able to give some testimony as well. So as we go through, if you can identify yourself for the tape and talk into the mic, and welcome to the committee. I'll just let you decide who wants to talk.
Just a question first.
Just go right ahead.
Okay, my name is Barb Cruz. I'm a community liaison with the Bloomington Richfield Early Reading First Program, and I'm here as an interpreter for a parent, Maralda Pineda.
Hola, muy buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Miralda Pineda y tengo un hijo del programa de Kesseri llamado Joshua.
Good evening. My name is Maralda Pineda and I have a son in the Get Ready program. His name is Joshua Pineda.
No pensé nunca tener esta oportunidad de agradecerles infinitamente porque mi hijo y yo nos hemos visto beneficiados con el programa de Get Ready.
I never thought I'd have this opportunity to thank you. I am so grateful for what my child has received, all the benefits he's received through the Get Ready program.
Y por supuesto que me gustaría que siguieran ayudando con esta causa a que otros niños y otras madres, al igual que el mío, se beneficie con el programa. Joshua.
Of course, I would like to see funding for this program continue so that other families, mothers, and children can receive the great benefit that we have received.
Mi hijo ha aprendido, yo creo que en seis meses, el idioma inglés. Domina también el español, pero ha aprendido también a escribir su nombre, los colores, a distinguir las frutas y a distinguir otras cosas.
My son has learned Spanish in the time that he has been in this program. And he has also learned to write his name. He has learned to identify different objects. He still speaks Spanish fluently, but he's able to identify many objects, including fruits and shapes in English as well.
Y esto me hace pensar y ver que es benéfico para él. Es benéfico para otros niños. Joshua ha tenido mucha atención por parte de las maestras.
I've noticed Joshua has benefited greatly from this program, and
y creo que hay otras madres y otros niños esperando por esa ayuda.
And I know that there are other children and other families, mothers, waiting for the same kind of benefits that we have received.
Mi hijo estará solamente tal vez siete meses ahí, pero soy una madre soltera que se me hace difícil dar un day, creo que me lo cuide. Y el estar en Get Ready me parece que él está seguro, que él está aprendiendo y que él está superándose y preparándose para el kindergarten.
My son has only been there for 7 months, but as a single mother, it's very expensive to find any kind of child care and especially to find something where he can be learning and preparing himself for kindergarten.
Y no quisiera quitarles más su tiempo, simplemente agradecerles y decirles gracias por esa ayuda que me han brindado con mi hijo y lo han hecho con otros padres de familia.
I don't want to take any more of your time. I just want to thank you for all of the help that we have received and for all of the benefit that you have given to other families as well. Thank you.
My name is Yolanda Gant and I'm here as a parent for Head Start. I have 5 children. And the youngest one right now is in Head Start, Hamilton Head Start, and she really benefits from this program. She was shy, nervous, just like I am now. And by her going to Head Start, when she first started, she kind of didn't socialize with the other children. Now she benefits because she's the talk of the class. She's always talking. She comes home and she talks, and it's her brothers. Because she has 3 brothers, if they are in the fight, she's the head of the person to solve the problem and try to make friends. And I benefit also with the Head Start program because I was able to get active into my community. I was able to join policy council and be here today. It's something I never thought I'd do. So it has helped my whole family a lot in a lot of areas that I would have never thought I can do. And then my children going on in District 196 has also blossomed, and I can see it. There is a big difference. And, of course, my baby girl, she seems brighter and smarter than the boys, but she has learned how to count, she can read, and she can write. And I didn't see that in the boys, but for a 3-year-old to see her read and write, it really benefited going to this program. And I'd like to thank you, and hopefully you keep the program going.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jean Eliasson. I am a grandmother living. I have 4 grandchildren in custody now.
Can you please put the mic a little closer to you?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, grandmother of 4 children in custody of them. And when I took this on, it was a labor of love, of course, and I found that the children needed a lot of, even kind of inhibited at home a lot, you know. And so Head Start was the option, and through the CAP agency, they made quick steps to get the 2 children that were eligible. It was 3 years ago. So anyway, the children began Head Start, and they identified all of the things that they were behind on. I became a representative for the early childhood Head Start, and they also have a home outreach, which was for the little guy. He was only a year old at that time. They had teachers coming right to the home and helping me adjust and teach him things that he had missed out on. And through that, he is now in his first year of Head Start. He's 3 years old, and he's in his first year of Head Start, and he can speak now where he wouldn't even talk. He wouldn't. It's just all the educational things that they had to offer, early ages and stages testing. They give you suggestions on papers that they, you know, and then direct you as far as how to teach him at home yourself and work with him. It came out once a week for him. Brittany and Caitlin were both in Head Start and shy, backward, not, you know, able to do anything. Nothing. I mean, with their literacy program and all the good teaching and the suggestions and the testing that they do, they found that these children did need IEPs. They call them District 196, and had teachers from early childhood special ed come in and help along with after they had tested them, they found that they went on further so that they identified the problems that these children have. This is an invaluable program. Caitlin is now in Kindergarten Plus, and she's just super. She's just done wonders. She can read. When I was in elementary school, I couldn't any way in first grade read. All of these things have been given to these children totally through the Head Start program and early childhood education. So hopefully there will be lots of support there for other children to achieve what they've done for my grandchildren. I'm so grateful and thankful.
Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Barbara Waltz, and I'm the director of the Scott Carver Dakota CAP Agency Head Start Program. And these are, of course, 2 of my parents. In a nutshell, I think I just need to tell you a couple of challenges that we have before us. Just to refresh your memory, all Head Start children live under the poverty level. And that means that the family of 4 can make no more than $20,000 in a 12-month period of time. And that is a very low income level. We are able to serve in Scott Carver and Dakota County 461 children. I have 320 slots from the federal government, and I have 111 from the state government. Right now, as of my last report, I have 428 children on my waiting list in Scott Carver and Dakota counties. So I have more children on my waiting list than I have in my program. The chances that they will get in this year are literally non-existent. So that means I have, actually there's 259 of those children meet that guideline, that federal poverty guideline. They will not get into Head Start this year, and they will go to kindergarten without a preschool experience. And we know statistics tell us that poverty and poor school achievement are directly linked. So they're going to go to school with a deficit that many of them are going to find very difficult to overcome. So what my message to you is, we need more slots for Head Start children. And if I had them, I could fill those centers tomorrow. So as you make your decisions, I hope you will keep that in mind. And thank you so much for listening to us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Dennis Demers. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Tri-Valley Opportunity Council, which is located in Crookston, Minnesota. I happen to live in East Grand Forks. We are a private, nonprofit corporation, a community action agency, which has, since 1970, served a silent population, migrants in Minnesota. Tri-Valley is the sole grantee in the state of Minnesota for migrant Head Start. We serve approximately 1,000 children in 15 sites throughout the state, all the way from the Canadian border to the Iowa border. We provide these services in concert with school systems throughout the state. In fact, it was kind of funny to come here tonight and find out that a member of our policy council is the superintendent of the school here, because Jay, as a member of our migrant policy council, when he was a superintendent over in Sleepy Eye. We provide services to children and families when they come to the state of Minnesota, which is typically somewhere between March and leaving between the end of the summer months all the way to the end of November. We provide services to children who are 6 weeks of age to compulsory school age. Before rules and regulations became more restrictive, and we are grateful that they are, we were actually serving children that were 5 and 6 days old. Our services last anywhere from 7 weeks to 27 weeks of service, depending on the needs in the community, which are determined by the families and the communities in which they reside. We operate anywhere from 8 hours a day to 14 hours a day, depending again upon the resources available and the needs of the community. We have 651 staff, 40% of whom are bilingual. The shift in the state of Minnesota from migrants was from the Red River Valley, originally from Representative Eakin's country, is now moving down to Representative Stigham's part of the country. The shift has moved from sugar beets to canning and general field work. The best that I can hope for is that as you consider and make very difficult decisions today and throughout the session, don't forget Head Start. And please, don't forget the migrant kids. Thank you.
I'm Brett Bussey, and I'm a resident of Apple Valley, and I grew up in Burnsville, but my dad grew up in Crookston. All kinds of small world things happening, yeah, it's crazy. I'm here tonight to talk about ECFD. My wife Kate and I started taking our daughter Claire to ECFE classes about 6 years ago when she was just a few months old. And education and the opportunity to interact with other parents in the same situation was absolutely tremendous. Now we have three young kids, Jack, who's 4, and Will is 3, all of whom, by the way, are homesick, so when I'm done, I'm going to cut out. But the parenting skills I learned in class were absolutely invaluable for helping to raise these three wonderful kids. My wife still gets together with the moms that she met in that class 6 years ago. They formed an immediate bond, and since they're still in the same situation now with kids and the same age and multiple kids, they continue to learn from each other. And I just think that's just a fantastic story, and they think it's just the best group they've ever had. I took several classes just for dads, and there aren't a lot of resources out there for dads. These classes provide the opportunity to meet other guys in the same situation, new fathers trying to balance work, marriage, kids, and trying to help each other all figure out how to do it all. That's the best way I can think of to strengthen a family and a marriage for that matter. ECFE and school readiness programs really are an investment in our entire community. Parents get better at being parents. Kids are better prepared for school and the rest of their lives. Parents get involved early and stay involved. Kids do better in school. Families meet other families facing the same challenges and learn ways to overcome them. Everyone in the community wins when that happens. None of this is for families of a specific social or economic level. All families with young children need education and support to do one of the most difficult jobs we have. I have 2 bachelor's degrees and an MBA, which did nothing to prepare me for this job. I've had classes with lawyers and guys working 2 jobs to make ends meet. We are all able to learn something from every discussion, and from each other, and from the great teachers. The teachers' training and all the research behind it really provides answers to so many questions that we just can't find anywhere else. It's fantastic. After I benefited so much from the program, I joined the district's advisory council. I served 3 years, my last 2 as co-chair. My time in the council was some of the most rewarding work I've ever done. I've been intimately aware of the positive impact these programs have on all the families in our community and the loss that we felt that the programs would cut. I'm now the chair of a foundation, the Foundation for Early Childhood and Family Services. We're a nonprofit foundation dedicated to raising funds for our district's program. We're constantly searching for donations and grants. And while this work is equally rewarding, and I'm extremely proud to be part of such an important endeavor, I think it's sad that we exist at all. And I'd really like to think that someday we can dissolve the foundation because the program itself is financially sound without our help. But I know that's pie in the sky. And so instead, we're not going to pretend there's a silver bullet solution and there's going to be one answer to our problem. We hit up the school board, as Mr. Curry can attest, local businesses, parents, large foundations like McKnight, and you guys, because you can help. We do this because we know how important it is to start early. Investing when kids are 5 and in kindergarten is too late. We have to think about helping children and parents long before kindergarten if we really want to make a difference. I'd love to reach some of our school readiness ELL students when they're 3, but we can't even do it for the kids who are 4. One of our programs, and I think my favorite program, is Family School. It's a family literacy program supported with ECFE funds, and it's an example of how ECFE dollars support our neediest families with the most intense programming. Each year, we head up to the Capitol with a group of immigrant families from this program to meet with our local reps and senators. A lot of you have seen us before, and if you haven't seen us before, we're coming. The stories these families tell really are amazing, and I still think a lot about a woman I met a couple years ago named Elizabeth from Mexico. She'd been in the program for all of about a year, and all the English she knew was from that program. She got up every morning at 2:30 to deliver papers. Then she got home at 5 and went back to bed until 7. Then she and her husband and their 2-year-old went to family school together until lunch. Her husband then went to work at night. They were working on their GEDs, learning to become citizens, and both planned to go to college. I know that family's working way harder than mine, and I guess probably harder than anybody else in this room. They can't imagine life without family school. And I can't imagine a better example of how worthwhile these programs really are. I'd like to respectfully encourage the committee to make sure the Education Committees have enough money to adequately fund these programs. The current discussion of restoring funding to previous levels is a good place to start, but it's still not enough. You've got a tremendous opportunity now to do the right thing. I hope it happens. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tom Holton, Executive Director of Community Education for Bloomington Richfield Schools. I'd like to thank the Chair and the Committee for coming and hearing all of us tonight. I'd like to share a little bit about the Bloomington Richfield story tonight, but it's representative, I think, of many early ed programs across the state of Minnesota. I'd like to share what we believe in, some of the things we've accomplished, and some of the challenges that we all share together. One is, it's our primary goal to prepare all students for school success. Everything that we do, we always look at that goal of having kids ready for kindergarten, including those at most risk for not being successful, those that are likely to be in the achievement gap. We truly believe that all parents, and you just heard one testify very eloquently, that all parents are primary teachers of their children. We can't forget that. So we have a parenting component in all the programs that we do. And we believe, like Art Rolnick, Rob Grunwald, and many that have done the studies that say early education is an investment we can't afford to cut back on. Our model in Bloomington Richfield, again, as it does across the state of Minnesota, includes choices, programs with varying intensities, and they're based on student and family needs. I'd like to compare early education to health care. In a perfect world, you'd need very little of either. All kids need well baby visits, vaccination, and an occasional antibiotic. Similarly, in order to be successful, all preschool-age children need some kind of help getting started. Much of that help is provided at home for many of our kids. But just like we just heard from many of the people, many parents need help teaching their children. We are not born with that, and we don't learn that just by osmosis along the way. And then there are many children in our program, from socioeconomic reasons to English language learners, that need more intensive interventions and care. Similarly to people in healthcare, there are some people that need some major surgery. And we all know that the well baby visit is much cheaper than going in for major surgery. In our program, we have at least a dozen program components. You've heard about many of those programs. You've heard about them tonight. Early childhood family education. We, too, have a family school program. We do school readiness. We have an early reading first program, which is not a state-funded program, but one I'm going to talk about in a minute. We combine our work with early childhood special education, preschool screening, primary project, make tracks, and preschool enrichment. Again, serving the various needs of families with many choices for families to make. I'm going to try to stay within my 5 minutes, so I'm not going to talk about each one of those programs. But I am going to talk about various intensity of programming and the associated costs that go with it. We also think we give a great return on the dollar because we coordinate our efforts in all that we do. We coordinate our efforts in our family school with adult basic education, special education, our diversity program, with public health, and with all the other programs in our Bloomington and Richfield public schools. We align our program to what happens in kindergarten, first grade, and second grade. We don't start and stop again as early learners and school-age learners, so we align what we do in both our curriculum, our instruction, and our assessment. And that assessment tells us when we're successful, and it tells us when we need to make program changes. And I'll share some of those results with you as well. If you didn't get it already, we'll pass out a handout, and on page 4 of your handout, I've included a chart. And it gets us to some of the issues that we're facing right now. Most or all of you are very aware of the Early Childhood Family Education Program funded by the state of Minnesota. I've included in there a chart that starts in 1987, 20 years ago, when Minnesota led the way in the nation in early childhood funding. The line on that graph represents a 2% increase every year from 1987 over 20 years. And if we'd follow just a 2% per year increase, we'd be at a whopping $125.56 per student. Currently, for 2007, we're funding that program at $112 per student per year. So 20 years, that's the kind of progress we've made. All of the things you heard about in ACFE come from that investment of $112 and then many, many parent fees and foundations and coordinating work with others. If you go on to the next graph, the other major funding in school-based early childhood education is our school readiness program. I've included a graph there of the funding level for Bloomington in the year 2001. We received $123,000 to serve all of our 3- and 4-year-olds in 2001. In 2007, we're receiving $111,000. Would anyone like to venture a guess if our needs have gone up or gone down in that period of time? And again, with a 2% increase in funding, we'd be at a level of $139,539. That's to serve 1,832 3- and 4-year-olds. If you want to do the math for the both of those programs, $111,000 per student for ECFE and $65 per student for school readiness. I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about intensive programming. As you might imagine, for $111 and $65 a year, intensity can't be very high, because that's about the cost of a pizza or a few cups of coffee over the course of the year. In Bloomington and Richfield, we were one of the few fortunate districts to get a federally funded grant to look at high-intensity programming and what works for our most challenged learners. Those learners, again, that come from where English is a second language at home, or those that are in poverty. The federal grant, which is a 3-year grant, allows us to serve 90 children per year, 3- and 4-year-olds, at the cost of about $1 million per year. 6.5 hours a day, 5 days a week, and 46 weeks of the year. That's a very intense level of programming. And again, we were one of the few districts that got to try that program and do the studies to see how effective it is. In that program, again, we're serving the most. ...71% are of diverse background, and 90% are in poverty, and that compares with 31% and 26% of our districts collectively. If you look at the next graph, you'll see the kind of results we receive from that programming. So we don't just know that we're doing good things and occupying kids, we're actually measuring with assessments to see how our children are doing. And you can see on that chart our first cohort of students and how they've done compared to their general students in kindergarten, as well as those that didn't receive the program that are of the same diverse and socioeconomic background of those students that didn't get in the program. We, too, through our early childhood screening, which is funded by the state of Minnesota, have identified 200 children that would qualify for this program. And there are a couple more charts there showing the extraordinary results. In summary, I'd like to point to the program revenue when we talk about intensity of programming. We currently spend about $11,000 in early reading service to reach those extraordinary results. Grades K-12, we get about $6,000 per person, $3,600 in kindergarten. We get $112 and $60 in ECFE and school readiness. So we have an intensity problem, and so I suggest to you that you look real carefully at not only restoring the program funding cuts in early childhood family education and school readiness that have been made over the last few years, but also look at funding those programs at those students most at risk at a more significant level. Thank you for your attention.
Good evening. I'm Elaine Greer. I'm a family child care provider and early childhood educator, and I live just two blocks over
Could
here.
Could I ask you, I'm sorry, would you please spell your last name for us?
G-R-E-E-R, Greer. Just live two blocks over here. My two children attended Pilot Knob, and of the 30 years I've lived in Eagan, many of the child care children that I've cared for have come here also. The wonderful thing that I've heard from teachers here is how prepared the children have been when they've come to the school for my child care. And I'm very humbled and grateful for that feedback, because I feel that early childhood education belongs in family child care. There are approximately 10,000 child care providers, family home providers, in Minnesota, and they serve 100,000 children. So when you think of it in that aspect, you really touch the lives of a lot of children. So how important it is that we provide early education and quality child care in the early years. Because children's development from birth to five really lays the foundation for what will follow for them. A couple of programs that I wanted to mention that I've been involved in, first of all, is the development grant that has been available to child care providers. It has been wonderful because it has enabled them to educate themselves in the professional development and development of children. And that leads to quality programs. I think that we need to go on learning throughout our whole life. When people decide to come into the profession of child care, that's exactly what it should be as a profession for them. And their continued education is very important in that respect. A couple of other programs that have been influential are the TEACH program, where providers can get a degree in early childhood education. I know several providers that have taken advantage of that and have been very grateful for that program. The other one is the Retain program. Unfortunately, the average number of years that child care providers remain in child care is approximately 3. And we feel like if you invest more into keeping quality providers in the field, that you're better off. And so the Retain is an incentive program that gives providers incentives to stay in family child care longer. Another program is the OWNS program of observation and reporting. This program actually is doing a research study right now with the University of Minnesota, and I'm proud to be one of the trainers in that program. The wonderful thing about it is that it involves parents, and parents are learning along with the providers about appropriate development in children and raising them to high standards. I'm very excited about that program. The other one is the infant toddler intensive, and that is a program of training from the very youngest of children through school age. I guess what I feel is that it's really important to raise children to be able to be successful in school. And that starts when they're born, and family child care is a big part of that. So I would encourage you to fund the programs that would support the family child care program. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the panel and ask at this time if anyone from the committee or from the audience has any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to hear a little bit more about this high-intensity model that you explained. There were three programs like this in the metro area in Minnesota. One of them was Bloomington. That's the one you were addressing.
That's correct.
And the figures that you have in here are $1 million a year for 90 children. This is only for reading.
These are all early learning literacy skills. And the assessments are done based on the same assessments that we give all of our entering kindergarten students.
How much more, Madam Chair, and how much more training do the teachers need for this? That's included in the $1 million per year.
Absolutely, as is all the support services of transportation, food, and the evaluation. The federal grant required an outside evaluator, so there's some costs that are they're higher than what you'd have to do to replicate the program. But the teachers are licensed teachers and go through an intensive training and ongoing coaching in teaching the literacy skills.
Where are the other two, Madam Chair and sir?
Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Okay. Now, have they been, Madam Chair?
And Cass Lake.
Have they been evaluated at all as to the results? Or haven't they been running long enough or what?
A requirement of the grant is to have an outside evaluation of the program.
But has that been done yet, Madam Chair, or are we still waiting for? I want to know, because that sounds to me like the kind of program you need in the inner cities and in your particular area. So what are the results of this, or haven't they been measured yet?
I don't have the particular results of the other grants at this time. However, there are replications of similar programs across the country, and that's part of the purpose of having the grants is to assess the effectiveness. And as you can see, if they're close to what we've done, we're achieving the kind of results that you'd hope to have.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to begin by thanking the testifiers. I have a specific question for Ms. Waltz, and I want to thank you for sharing with us the concrete story you have in your counties. Can you tell me a little bit, or maybe just give me a rough estimate of what it would cost to move the wait list into the program, or conversely, what is the cost of a slot?
Chair, I can tell you it costs for one child to attend Head Start. The allocation is about $6,500 per child. So I don't have my calculator with me, but you can do the math on that. And that is for full services for families. We are a comprehensive program, and we look at all aspects of the family and the child, including health, mental health, nutrition, dental, and we also serve children with disabilities. And we transport them.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Pope.
Mr. Demers, just a clarification. How many students do you serve in your 15 locations?
Chairman and Representative Holbrook, we have 1,000 children in 15 sites in the state of Minnesota.
And if I might just follow up, you said you had 641 staff members for 1,000 students.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Holbrook, 651 staff last summer. Mr. Chairman and Representative Holbrook, because we're serving infants and toddlers, we're transporting children, we have aides on the buses, janitors, etc., that's the ratio that you almost have to have if you're going to be able to meet the regulations in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Flawless.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you all for your testimony and say how important it is and how compelling it is for you to talk about early childhood to this particular group, because they're going to be the final stop kind of on the finance train. The committee is focusing on closing the achievement gap, So for those of you from Head Start, thank you for testifying for Yolanda, Jean, Barb, and Dennis. That's really important. We're going to be having some more testimony on that, and I hope and invite you to come to before the committee. To Brett, thanks for testifying about ECFE, and you know how important that is, and we want to have you come down and talk about that parenting component. And Tom, we know how important the funding is. And to Elaine, especially in child care, that's it's in our committee in early childhood, but it's very important to put this part of the picture because that's where a lot of the kids are. And to Miralda, gracias. Thank you for your testimony. So I just wanted to let you know we're focusing on closing the achievement gap, we're focusing on quality in child care, and we're focusing on citizen engagement. So you are making this come true and painting the picture for the legislators, and I thank you for that.
Representative Kahn. Thank you. Does Head Start everywhere have the same cutoff of requiring income under the poverty level? Or does that change from place to place?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Kahn. Yes, that is a federal guideline. And whatever the federal guideline is, the state, as they give money to us, asks us to adhere to those same federal performance standards. So 90% of the children who attend Head Start must live under the poverty level. We are allowed to have 10% of our total population over the poverty level. However, in my case, if I have a child on my waiting list who meets that poverty guideline, that is the child who will get enrolled first. Therefore, this year, we can have about 45 children over the poverty guideline. This year, I have under 30 that are over because of the fact there are so many children who actually meet that poverty guideline waiting for the program.
Okay. Representative Carlson, and then I'm going to ask that we move on to the next group, which would be considering K-12. Representative Carlson.
I'd like to go back to the racial question with Mr. Demers. When you say 651, is that a full-time equivalent, or are there part-time staff included in that? Just for clarification.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, those are not full-time equivalencies. Those are temporary positions.
So what would be the FTE then?
The FTE would be about 300.
Okay, that's why I asked the question, because I suspected as soon as you said bus drivers and so on that there were a number of part-time people. No, thank you.
Madam Chairman, yes, Mr. Carlson.
That was a friendly question.
I think I'm going to get the final question here. And this is for the gentleman from Richfield and Bloomington. I'm curious if after the high-intensity 3- and 4-year-old pro-day or all-day kindergarten in Richfield and Bloomington.
Richfield has added all-day kindergarten as of this year for all of their children. And in Bloomington, we are in the process and have just approved a program to carry those children to provide all-day experience for those children that come out of programs like this that still haven't met the criteria of being ready for kindergarten, because we know that there is not a quick fix, and many of the barriers that are affect those children continue with them. So we're planning to provide an all-day experience for our most at-risk learners to make sure we don't lose ground.
Thanks. Thank you, panel. I'm going to, first of all, just want you all to know how valuable your testimony was. We do deeply appreciate it. And at this time, I'd like to invite those who are going to be speaking to K-12 to come to the table.
As there are We change panels if there are questions from the audience to make sure that you feel free to ask those questions. And we do have a couple of cards from, is it an Amy Carey, Debbie Crone, is that right? If you can want to come up here now, if you want to wait until you get done, you can make your statements later on if you want to.
Thank you. If you could keep your comments brief and introduce yourselves, say your name and where you're from for the tape, please.
Okay. My name's Rob Schumer, and I'm a lecturer at the University
of Minnesota. Could you put the mic closer to your mouth, please?
I'm Rob Schumer. I'm a lecturer from the University of Minnesota.
Thank you. You can go ahead.
I can go ahead. I'll make it very brief. It'll be a nice transition, I think, from the previous conversation. I've been in education for almost 40 years, taught at UCLA in Minnesota, and been a school teacher, and just wanted to make a few comments and bring up some reports, actually, that I would hope that you might look at, because I think they're important. In relationship to the previous conversation about early childhood, if you haven't seen the recent edition of Education Week, called From Cradle to Career, it comments on chances for success of young people around the country. The good news is that Minnesota is third on the list. The bad news is that, as we know, is that education across Minnesota is not evenly distributed. And there are three areas out of the 13 that are important, I think, for you to consider. And the first is early childhood education, all-day kindergarten, and dropout prevention programs. Those seem to be the most critical areas if we're thinking about the future of children that we need to invest in. Following the dropout prevention area, there is a report that came out sponsored by the Gates Foundation. If you haven't seen it, it's called The Silent Epidemic. Major study interviews with dropouts to find out why they leave school, what are the problems with schools. And the sad part for me to talk to you is I probably said some of these same things almost 40 years ago about why kids drop out of school. I had written a chapter it said that there were only three problems with schools. They were passive, isolated, and boring. Other than that, they're great. And I don't mean boring in a way to insult teachers, but boring in a way that young people need to have voice and have choice in the kinds of things that they do. One of the things that's important to me, I used to be the director of the National Service Learning Clearinghouse, was that young people are asking for active programs. They're asking for programs that are relevant, internships, service learning. And in fact, I mentioned service learning, and I'll accelerate my comments to allow others to speak, is that service learning is an opportunity both in the K-12 schools and the universities for students to do community service and earn academic credit. I used to run an alternative high school where my students spent 70% of their time in the community earning all of their academic credit through community work. You can learn to read, you can write, you can learn physics, you can learn all of the academics that we think that are important through meaningful work. And so as you think about funding proposals and funding efforts, I suggest you contact the Campus Compact. Minnesota Campus Compact is considered a leader in the nation, and part of their mission statement is to connect higher education with K-12 so that we can improve not only the quality of education in higher education, but do a great service to the young people in our early childhood and K-12 systems. That's probably enough to say. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Schumer.
Hi, I'm Todd Otis, president of Ready for K. Thank you for inviting me to talk about early childhood for 5 minutes. This is a really important subject, and we really appreciate the chance to talk about it. In terms of priorities for the state, we think it's the most important priority. We would love to have you look at all the spending alternatives and see where you can get a better return on investment. One of our board members is well known to many of you, Art Rolnick, who has done a lot of work on looking at that. So when you're deciding at the end of the day where to put the money, we're hoping that you'll look at return on investment. Currently, we only get 1% of the state budget for early care and education, and we would like eventually to see that to go to 2%. We think it's a really smart strategy also for helping narrow the achievement gap. I'd like to share a couple of statistics related to that just for your consideration. One, children with high-quality early learning experiences are 40% less likely to need special education or to be held back a grade. That can save money in K-12 and be really effective. A child who enters school reading below grade level has only a 1 in 8 chance of catching up. Think about that. And think about what we could do with those kids if they didn't have to face those steep odds. The data that Art and Rob Grunewald have done about the return on investment are really compelling. Ready for K has the vision of moving how many kids are ready for K from 50% to 80%. So when the superintendent and the board member were talking about a shared vision, that's really what I hope we can do with the legislature and the governor, is embrace the shared vision of 80% of our kids ready for K by 2012. If we did that and got on the path this year in this biennium, that would be huge. And we can do it. We know how to do it. It does cost money, but the payback is enormous. And it's going to not only ripple through K-12 and higher education, but through the workforce and through the quality of our life as a state. So I know we don't have a lot of time. I guess I will spare you a detailed description of our policy agenda. Suffice to say that it is about giving families, and parents are at the center of this, the best possible opportunity to give their kids what they need. In the early years, it can be visits to hospitals, home visiting, ECFE. It can be access to quality programs like Head Start and quality child care. A study done by DHS 2 years ago showed that using the same tool that the State Department of Education has used to assess school readiness, which has indicated that 50% of our kids are not fully prepared, using that same tool in accredited centers where the kids got really what they needed to get them ready for kindergarten teachers here, 80% of the kids were in that boat. So we know what works. It's a matter of having the will to get them the experience. Parents are at the center of it, but we really hope, tonight at least, I really hope you'll consider sharing the vision of moving the needle from 50% to 80% of our kids ready for K. Then let's talk about how we get there. Maybe we can have the Bipartisan Early Childhood Caucus be a place where that discussion happens. We'll be coming forward with ideas. We are very grateful for the speaker creating the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee and for the leadership that Representative Slawik is showing on that too. And with that, I will stop.
Thank you, Mr. Otis. I know that the panel has some questions, but I'm going to let the three who have stated that they would like to testify speak first, and then I'll open it up to questions. If you could please state your name into the mic and then also spell your name for us for the tape.
Hi, my name is Debbie Krohn, and it's K-R-O-H-N, and I am a kindergarten and first grade teacher here at Pilot Now. And I live in Brentsville and have two boys that are in fifth and ninth grade in the Brentsville School District. And what I want to speak to tonight is the impact that I've seen personally from the full-day kindergarten. Like I said, I've taught full-day, half-day, first grade, and I've also looped with those kids from kindergarten to first grade. And then this year I'm first grade, but I didn't loop with these kids, if that makes sense. And I can see the growth, especially when you were talking about the achievement gap with those higher-risk kids, those kids that come behind to school, either with exposure or with phonemic awareness, with language development, those kind of things. And with the increase that we've had in curriculum expectations, with high-stakes testing, and with wanting to close that achievement gap, it's really important as kindergarten teachers that we have the time to teach the kids the things that they need to know, to expose them to the experiences that they need. And it helps those high-risk kids, but it also benefits all the kids. And I've seen that as a kindergarten teacher, but also as a first-grade teacher. So I just wanted to speak from my own experience and encourage you to support all day, every day.
Thank you so much.
Good evening. My name is Ann Siegel, and I am an
all-day
F-I-E-G-E-L. I am an all-day, everyday kindergarten teacher here at Pilot Knob, and I am also the current president of the Minnesota Kindergarten Association. I am speaking to you tonight about the importance of fully funding kindergarten as a full unit instead of the current 0.5 unit. By doing this, it will enable districts across the state to offer all-day, everyday kindergarten to all students so they are equally educated. Of the 50 states in the union, 29 of them provide funding for all-day, everyday kindergarten. These statistics come from the Minneapolis Foundation. They have a wonderful publication that is available to you on their website. I encourage every one of you to look at it and request it. They have all of the statistics to back their research, because that's what their people do, and we as teachers, we are here to educate, and we don't have the time to go digging for what my job is here at school, not in the stacks of some library. They realize that it will cost more up front, but they know the payoff comes at the end. The Minnesota Kindergarten Association has a position statement that reads that we endorse an all-day, everyday kindergarten program. This program provides continuity and stability in learning, access to equal educational opportunities, and developmentally appropriate curriculum that meets the main needs of our diverse student population. And this was adopted in January of 2004. As a kindergarten teacher, when I started, I did half day, and now I'm doing full day. I know firsthand the benefit of all day, everyday kindergarten. It provides outstanding opportunities for those at-risk learners. And in my estimation, every child in school these days is at risk. When you look at what's out there, what's facing them, I don't care if they come from a family where both parents are home with great jobs, if mom is staying home all day, or if they're at a single mother family, or if I have several families that dad is the one there. They are all at risk. They just have to walk out on that street and they're bombarded with junk that we don't even want to know how they interpret. But I urge you to support and vote for this essential funding so that we can continue the quality education that they get in Head Start that Todd promotes for Ready for K. When they come to us as a half-day session, if they've been, they're only here 2.5 hours. That's it. And they come out of preschool programs where they've probably been there all day long. So you are cutting their education in half. It is unfair that that kindergarten children are not fully funded. We are the same as everyone else. And in my opinion, we're more important than anyone else because we're at the beginning. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Amy Crary, C-R-A-R-Y. I am a parent of two children from Pilot Knob, a second grader and a fourth grader. And Mr. Chairman, I was very lucky to have Austin in my one of the programs that I helped with, which is the junior grade book. So, my daughter went to half-day kindergarten for 2.5 hours. 2 years previously, because my husband had a good job, she went to all-day Montessori for 8 hours. So she went from 8 hours to 2.5 hours. That Montessori program put her above all the other children. She couldn't be in a reading group because she was so far ahead. But I was lucky enough to be able to afford that. I stopped working and stayed home with my son, and he went to a 3.5 hour, 3-day-a-week Christian preschool because our cost for ECFE, because we made a significant amount of money, was horrendous. If we had made a lower amount of money,
we could have enrolled them in the three-hour program at Somerset, but because we made too much money, it was cheaper for us to send our children to a private preschool program, which that's okay, we were able to do it. But then he was able to go to all-day kindergarten because I was able to find a full-time job and I was able to pay for the funding out of my flex dollars. And he did wonderfully. He had a sight problem, and in kindergarten he had strabismus surgery and over his eye. Very, very bright child, but he was behind on his writing. Had he been in a half-day kindergarten program, he probably would still be behind in second grade. But because he had that extra time to work on that, it was great. Most school districts do not fund all-day kindergarten. My sister and brother-in-law live in Farmington. They have chosen to serve the Lord. My brother-in-law is a youth minister. Between the property taxes and the cost to send their eldest to all-day kindergarten, they decided to move to Georgia because that school funds all-day kindergarten. And I just think, what a loss. It's a product of being known in Minnesota, coming from a good education, that they are moving out of state because they can't afford to live here because there's cost of housing in Dakota County is so high, and then bundling that they have to pay for their child to go to all-day kindergarten. They have two more coming up that they will have to pay for all-day kindergarten in 2 years, and they just knew they couldn't do that. So they decided to move out of state. I think it's great that the governor's looking at ways to reward students in college and give them scholarships for good grades. But what good does it do if they never make it to college? What good does it do? So you need to look at these Head Start programs, and you need to look at preschool programs, and you need to look at all-day kindergarten, because there are some skills that they may have at 3 and 4, but at 5, they take a big jump until they get to 3rd grade, when they all kind of catch up, and these miracle worker women and men in the district, I don't know how they do it, but I know that from teaching 2nd grade religion that all my kids can read now. When they started out, some could read when they walked in the door, and some could not. Some didn't even know letter K from letter Z. So I think you really need to look at that. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'll take questions now. I believe Representative Whipple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got a couple questions. Number one, early for K. You know, I talk to people. You know, I'm on several education committees, and I'm on the Early Childhood Caucus. So I hear a lot of this information, but people who think early childhood is maybe not as beneficial as they think, they say, because of what Mr. Carreri said, after 3rd, 4th grade, they all catch up. And what do you say to that question? And my second question is about kindergarten. My wife teaches, used to teach kindergarten, now 3rd grade. And sometimes she thinks all-day K is great because some kids can do it, and sometimes she thinks all-day K maybe isn't so great because the kids can't stay awake long enough. They get tired. And I talked to a couple different parents who said, yeah, it took them half a year before they had the stamina to finish kindergarten. Maybe they just started too early. I mean, we kept both our kids back a year because they were ready upstairs, but they weren't ready in the heart. They were too squirrely. But those are my two questions.
On the first question, it really is a matter of trying to improve the odds for any individual child. There will be kids who are way behind who do catch up with the miracle workers and others doing it, but there's a lot of them who don't. And particularly if they're low income or they come from really stressed families, it's really hard to catch up. So getting them early and giving them a quality experience just really ups their odds. But any one child can overcome those odds. I guess that would be my best response.
Are there other questions?
I just, but I've seen statistics where kids, even though they caught up, the kids who have a quality early childhood education, a larger percentage of them actually go to college, stay out of jail, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess that's the answer that some people should hear. I'm a huge proponent. I used to be somewhat, well, I think it's a good idea, but I want to find out more. And now the more I see how the brain synapses works for kids that are in toddler, from 0 to 3 years old, the way the brain functions, if, you know, if a kid gets held and coddled and loved and pointed in the right direction and they get excited about something, their brain works differently than the sister and mom was watching TV, and so is the kid just sitting next to her watching something. But can you speak to that as far as statistics? Because I don't really remember the stats, and then someone can answer it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that the long term benefits for quality experiences, particularly for at risk kids, are that they are more likely to graduate from high school, more likely to go to college, more likely to own a home, less likely to commit a crime, less likely to be on public assistance. There aren't many, but those are what the longitudinal studies say, and that's the basis for our Rolnick's return on investment estimates. Again, we would never give up on any one child, but in terms of just the odds are a lot better if they have a quality experience early on.
If you'll... We'll take a look at this Education Week, Chances for Success. They talk about the importance of early childhood education and all-day kindergarten. Reading and middle school math are major predictors of successful graduation and success in careers. The only caveat, I started as a reading teacher in high school, so I saw kids at the other end who hated reading and didn't like school. You can help some of those kids if you have the kind of experiential, active learning programs in middle schools and high schools that allow students to catch up on math and reading by doing things that are meaningful for them. The drill and kill kinds of things that are often done to kids in middle school and high school who haven't been successful does not help, and those are the kids who have a much higher tendency to drop out of school. So I think that if there's evidence, and Rolnick and lots of people have done the studies to show that early childhood education, all day kindergarten, are two of probably the best investments anybody can make in our educational system.
All right. We'll take one last follow-up question, and then we do need to move to our higher education study. Representative Wilson, do you have one more question?
No, in interest of time, you don't need to hear me anymore.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Is anyone in the audience wanting to make a comment on what we just heard or ask a question? All right. If we could hear from those who are prepared to speak to higher education, and I would also like to invite up Rick Howden, Scott Formo, and Tyler Swinger. Would you like to join the panel? Would you please introduce yourselves and tell us where you're from and what you represent? And go ahead and speak right after the introduction.
Good evening. I'm Ron Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S, president of Dakota County Technical College, and Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us tonight, and we look forward to sharing a few comments.
What I would like to do in the few minutes that I have is just set the stage for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities budget and make a few comments. My colleague will introduce herself, Dr. Cheryl Frank, president of Denver Hills, will make some further comments. And then we would like to give you a couple of examples of some real-life cases and issues that we're dealing with at our own particular colleges. I think we've got a great start. I was pleased to see some positive movement this year in higher education, but I think we have a long ways to go. The game is not over yet. I don't know which inning we're in, but it's not the ninth inning yet. A few comments. The need for public higher education in this state has never been greater. We see it every day. We need more college graduates, more highly skilled workers to compete in a global society. Minnesota State Colleges and University Systems addresses these challenges every day by meeting the changing workforce needs, new programs such as biotech and nanotech, which we are well known for at our college, health informatics, and by continuing to increase the numbers of graduates annually. 32 state universities, community and technical colleges serve 370,000 students each year in credit and non-credit courses. Every year, more than 33,000 students graduate, and more than 80% of them stay in Minnesota. The investment that you make and the taxpayers make is well documented and returns about $10.87 in economic activity to the state. A couple of other interesting things. We also educate about 80% of the nursing graduates. We provide up to about 53% of the teaching graduates, 92% of the law enforcement officers, and 91% of the construction graduates. And I'll have maybe a couple of comments a little bit later about technical education and why we also need to continue to invest in that. I'll turn it over to Dr. Frank.
Again, I'm Cheryl Frank, president of Ember Hills Community College, and we appreciate very much having higher education represented as well, because we know the difference that a college education can make, and we're trying to help our students achieve and stay until they reach their goals, whether it be in community college or our universities, to make a difference in our students' lifetime earnings for themselves and their families. The Minister Biennial Budget Request, first of all, we're asking for inflation dollars. We know that over the past some years here, our enrollment has continued to substantially increase, while the state's ability to contribute to higher education was decreasing, and that has resulted in tuition increases for our students. And we so very much at this point in time want to keep tuition as affordable as possible as we can for our students. And to do that, we're first of all asking for inflation dollars to help cover all of the costs that have been increasing, as you heard in K-12, with health insurances and utilities and needing to keep up our institutions, as well as offer all of the quality programs that our students need. We've got a couple of special initiatives, too, that we're going to be asking for, and the first one is technology infrastructure improvements. MNSU's current technology infrastructure is seriously outdated and inadequate to meet the demand for up-to-date classroom and teaching techniques, internet access, and fast-growing online student services and programs. So with the money that we're asking for with this technology infrastructure, we hope to deliver more online programs and services to employers and high schools, protect sensitive data and enhance computer network security, increase online learning, improve student services, and finally, improve management and of business processes. In addition, initiatives we hope to be able to move forward are recruiting and retaining more students from groups traditionally underrepresented in higher education, producing more graduates in science, technology, engineering, and math to help keep Minnesota competitive, supporting the growth of the state's burgeoning bioscience industry by establishing a biosciences center of excellence, increasing the number of nursing graduates to help avert a predicted nursing shortage, and finally, encouraging innovation by faculty and staff. So these things, we think, will really help stabilize
higher education, and again, we need your help very much so to keep tuition as affordable as possible for our students.
All right, thank you.
May I follow up this for a couple of minutes, please?
I'd like for us to also get to our young men here. I'm sure they have some important things.
I know that several of you at the table have been at our college, and as a matter of fact, Representative Medora, you were at a grand signing last week, and in 2 days we'll be involved with another grand signing. What we do is workforce development at our college. We're very good at it and very proud of that. But it's also about expansion of businesses. It's about business retention. Let me give you a real-life example of technology issues that are facing our colleges and facing all of us in higher education. I'm reminded last year when we had a major grant through GE to work with one of the major companies in Twin Cities. And they were very pleased because we were going to do ESL training, lean manufacturing, safety training, and so on. But following the discussion and after the grant signing, the CEO came up to me and he said, "Ron, I love what you're doing, but we would like to be able to package that and deliver that to the other 10 facilities across the country. Can you do that online?" The answer was no, because we did not have the infrastructure to be able to do that. Now, in 2 days, we'll be at the largest, one of the largest biotech companies to begin another Minnesota job skills training program. I hope that that question comes up again. And I hope that by next year that we can respond to the affirmative, that if we need to take the training internationally or nationally, that we have the support from the legislature and the governor in order to be able to do that. So those are some real life stories.
Thank you. My very, very quick story from Inver Hills Community College, if we would get these dollars. You know, we are now first-ring suburb. 44% first-generation college students attend Inver Hills. We have an initiative we call Finish What You Start. And what we would like to do is really to lift up some of the student retention initiatives that we've been successful at through a little grant that came through the legislature to MNSCU that we competed for that has demonstrated some significant retention for our most at-risk students. So Finish What You Start is a motto. I even have a shirt that I wear for student success days at the college. It says Finish What You Start. Everyone's got to have a plan. It takes more intrusive advising help work for the students that are at most risk. And we want to see a much higher percentage of them graduating, finishing their goal, continuing on to the university or state universities or a career job out if that's what they choose to do. So just two short examples, and now we should hear from some students.
Would you please state your name and spell your last name for the sake, please?
Yeah. My name is Rick Howden, H-O-W-D-E-N. I just want to thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing us to come and give a student's perspective on higher education as well, because I think that's very important and a part of the story that doesn't get told that often. I serve as the Vice Chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. I am also a student at Winona State University, where I'm a senior. Like many other middle-class families, my family was not able to save thousands of dollars to send me or my younger sister, who will be graduating from high school this May, to college. As a first-generation college student, tuition costs were not something that my family had made plans for from the beginning. I've had to take out loans to cover every year of my college career, and this will be my fourth year, and I will still have one more semester to go of worth of loans. That means that I will have a total of 4.5 years in student loans to cover everything from tuition, fees, books, residence halls expenses for 3 years, rent for 2 years, and living expenses. So far, I've borrowed $48,000. $36,000 of that is in private loans, which is accruing interest very rapidly. I already have more than $2,800 in interest on my private loans. Looking ahead, I'm very concerned about how I will be able to repay these loans. Now, I'm looking back a while ago now, I started to wonder where $48,000 in loans went over the last 4 years. So I did some calculations. I spent approximately $21,500 in tuition over the last 4 years. At Winona State University, we have a mandatory laptop program. And that has contributed to over $5,400 in fees that I've paid. In addition, I lived in the residence halls for 3 years, which cost a total of $8,700 for room and board. I also pay about $320 in rent at an apartment that I share with two others this year, which adds up to another $3,800. Finally, I pay an average of $500 per semester for textbooks, for a total of about $4,000 over 4 years. That means just to pay for tuition, fees, textbooks, and a place to live, that I spent over $43,400. That leaves me with a little over $1,100 a year, or $96 a month, for any other expenses that I may need. I was also working 20 hours a week this year, but it's still very difficult to make ends meet. As MSUSA's vice chair, I'm here not just to tell my own story about how student loan debt and high tuition have impacted me, but also to represent the thousands of other students attending our state universities who cannot be here with us today. The students I represent have started a new semester now, and some may be looking forward to graduating. Others will be returning next year. All of them, however, are looking for relief from large tuition increases and growing student debt. They are counting on you for help. During many campaigns, higher education costs were a frequent topic, with many candidates promising to help stop the rising cost of tuition. When the ballots were cast last fall, voters sent a message that higher education was a priority. Now, students are asking for help from legislators. We are asking for the Minsky system to be funded at a level that will freeze tuition at current levels for the next 2 years. Additional funding will help maintain the high-quality education offered at state colleges and universities while keeping tuition and student debt levels down. An investment in public higher education is an investment in the future of Minnesota. There's no time better than here and now to show Minnesota's commitment to higher education and its future. So thank you all for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott Formal, F-O-R-M-O. I'm a student at Alexandria Technical College and also the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, representing over 100,000 students from Minnesota's two-year public education, or public community and technical colleges. So now you've heard a lot of testimony about the evolution that takes place in the public education system, from early childhood to K-12, and now we're here to talk a little bit more about the final piece of that system, higher education. During the Minnesota statute reads that instructional services shall equal 67% of the estimated total cost of instruction for the University of Minnesota, the state universities, and the community colleges, and for technical colleges. That's 67% of the estimated total cost of instruction. Higher education needs to be a top priority in the state of Minnesota. Total appropriation for students has continued to decline over the past 6 years, leaving Minsky students currently paying 49% of the educational costs, while the state only contributes 51% of that. College and university students have shared in the pain during the budget deficit of 2003. During the 2003 legislative session, the Minnesota State Colleges and University System was cut $191 million. As the state has moved away from its commitment to fund higher education, that burden has fallen on the backs of students through tuition increases. Tuition has risen system-wide 68.5% in the past 6 years, making up $173.6 million, or 91% of that $191 million cut. A few minutes ago, a graph was passed out to you, which shows the average tuition for a full-time student at the two-year public colleges in Minnesota since fiscal year 1987. As you can see, there's three different areas that we're pointing out in that graph. The average tuition is shown in blue. The adjusted rates for the consumer price index are shown in pink. And the adjusted rates for the higher education price index are shown in yellow. As you can see, back in fiscal year 1987, all three of those were equal. Slowly over time, they started to expand and increase over time. But as you can see, starting in fiscal year 2002 and 2003, the two-year colleges has taken a dramatic jump in increase over the adjusted rates for the CPI and the HEPI. Currently, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education, students at Minnesota's two-year community and technical colleges are paying the second highest college tuition rate in the nation. This is problematic because our two-year campuses are meant to be the most affordable higher education institutions and an access point for all. If tuition is too expensive, certain students may be denied that access. And I'm going to pass it on to Mr. Slinger to continue to talk about higher education in our two-year system.
Thank you, Scott. My name is Tylor, T-Y-L-O-R, Slinger, S-L-I-N-G-E-R. I hail from Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, the Minnesota State Community and Technical College located in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. I'm currently enrolled in the AA transfer degree. On a day-to-day basis. And one of the interesting things that I saw as I walked around my campus and I started interacting with the people is that I'm one of the youngest individuals there at the community college. Being 19 years old and graduating in 2005, I had very few remedial courses and or steps back that I had to take into account. But when I look around at my student senate, specifically the other officers, my sergeant-at-arms, secretary, vice president, things, these people are usually a little bit older than I, if not significantly older. And some of them have had to take remedial courses and also have the responsibility of taking care of children, families, their wives, things like that. And it just kind of perplexes me sometimes walking around the campus. So the first point I'd like to make is that with the rising cost of tuition that has forced many of these people to take on full-time, part-time jobs and take out larger amounts of loans, that they're more likely to move on, not into jobs in the state, but probably out of state, specifically an individual who serves as our student senate sergeant-at-arms. He's 37 years old, two kids, a wife, and at the going rate for a network security programmer in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota is $11 with a two-year degree. And with about $12,000 with the loans after the 2 years, plus taking care of his kids and his family, he's not going to be able to do that with $11, so he's going to move where the money's at in order to take care of his responsibilities. Another interesting story is my secretary, the secretary at this, for the Student Senate, has two sons and a husband who's in Iraq at the moment, and she almost didn't decide to come back to school because of that, because of her husband going away and not knowing what the financial situation was going to be like. So I see this kind of as my responsibility as the Student Senate president to bring this to you and show you some of their interesting stories. And as the president from the college down there stated that, the two-year technical colleges play an intricate and very special part in the state's economy, being that we graduate 53% of the state's teachers, and primarily from the technical colleges, 78% of the nurses, and 92% of the law enforcement people, primarily from Alexandria and Hibbing technical colleges. And to kind of sum up, in the next 10 to 15 years, you have to see that a lot of the current people working are going to be moving out and retiring, as they should be. And if people are going to be wanting to move out of the state because they're not going to be able to pay off their tuition, then we're going to have a big employment gap. So I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me the opportunity to come speak before you this evening.
Thank you so much. Representative Cohn, you have a question?
Here. This might be addressed to all of the participants, but I guess I thought of it while Mr. Howden was speaking, so I'll start with him. First of all, I'm incredibly sympathetic to what you're saying, and I obviously went to college a very, very long time ago, and I was the second generation to go, and both of my parents were first generation, but at that time it was totally supportable. There was no question of any loans or anything like that. But the question is, so I agree, one of the things I completely agree with is that we do need to put more appropriations into higher education to bring our tuition rates at all institutions down. But we've got to get the money somewhere to do that. Or your parents or your neighbors and so forth, or, you know, we don't get to print it, and there isn't any great place that we can save it from, that I know of anyway. Do you think your parents, their neighbors, your friends will believe that we should have a higher level of taxation, at least at some levels, in order to have the money to make these appropriations?
I think that in the people that I've talked with about education, and since I've been involved with student issues for a couple of years now, the one thing that I've heard back from members of my community and my family is that talking about Minnesota's investment in education in the past and the history of it and how we have kind of built up a rapport of some sort about being leading in education and seeing that slip away now is something that worries a lot of members in my community. I know in my hometown in Cannon Falls that a lot of referendums are passed at our local state levels. And I think that not only at that level, but for my parents now to see the impacts of what I had to deal with in terms of student loan burden coming out of college, I think that is something that they would be supportive of, definitely being Minnesota's investment in higher education.
Do we have other questions from the panel? Yes, we have a question from the audience. Can you come up and state it into the mic and state your name for us, please?
Representative Kahn's question. I'm wondering if you're interested in answering the question.
Sure.
No, I was interested probably in the other panelists. I don't think I'll put Dr. Thomas or Dr. Frank on the spot, but I'm curious if the other students think that the citizens of Minnesota have thought of doing.
Take it from Steve.
Okay.
I guess. Personally, looking at my personal situation, I mean, I'm 36 years old. I have a 10-year-old son, recently divorced. I did move back in with my parents because they are helping to, you know, try to support me and get me through school because they realize the need for that. And just from my personal aspect, I'm anticipating that once I finish with my college degree, my 10-year-old son is going to be going to school here in a few years. I'm anticipating needing to contribute to that, both personally as well as through taxes. I know that with my family, we've talked about it a lot, and I don't know if necessarily, you know, raising taxes across the board is the exact correct answer. I do know that as students, we're also looking at a number of other issues to try to lower the cost of education and other ways to do it also. But at some point in time, we feel that the state is going to need to step up and somewhat take on that responsibility somehow and, you know, try as many ways as possible to avoid a tax increase before going that route. But as far as whether or not it would need to be done, personally, I personally believe that if I were asked to do it, I would do it for my son, and I would hope that many other people would do it for the future of Minnesota also.
Coming from Detroit Lakes specifically, I myself being a taxpayer and some of the individuals in Detroit Lakes would, but I would say the vast majority would not. When I was in high school in 2005, we attempted to pass a referendum, highly supported by the high school senior population that could vote, to get a tax referendum. I can't remember specifically what it was, to raise the taxes in the area for the high school, and the community shot it down. So I don't think Detroit Lakes specifically would agree, but I would hope that people would see the investment that this is, in fact, in the future of Minnesota and not just a short-term in paying tax dollars.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. Well, I think it's interesting. You've got one yes, one that wants us to try and find a way to save it within the system, and then one that's facing the reality at home that the folks probably don't want to do it. These are some of the things in how we face the tough decisions that we make. And I will tell you, I'll say that in the context we should freeze the tuition.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Are there other questions? Oh, one from the audience. Could you please identify yourself, please?
My name is Kathy Weinzettel, Weinzettel. And, as a taxpayer and a parent with kids with student loans, so I'm looking at it from both perspectives, I strongly urge you not to raise taxes for that. You need to look seriously at why are the costs of college going up, and can we put a lid on some things there that will prevent the tuition from rising? And second of all, maybe creating some incentives for the student and the parents to enable them to save money and maybe have some kind of a tax benefit if they do so. I know there are some things available like that now, but maybe take a closer look at how to make that work better so that they can provide for their own education and at the same time keep the tuition from rising by taking a serious look at what's causing the rises.
Thank you for your comments. Representative,
does anyone have any suggestion of what kinds of things they want to control to keep the tuition from rising? And I will say, I don't agree with my good friend, Representative McNamara, about the tuition freeze. At least the system that I'm most familiar with, the University of Minnesota, that would be disastrous in terms of what's needed for programs in order to maintain competitiveness. I'm not sure about other institutions, but anyway, does anyone have, are there any savings that anyone sees that we should be making that we're not making?
Well, NINSU will be talking about this as we go through the hearings in the Senate and House this week, but the budget that is proposed from all of us requests and anticipates a 4% per year tuition increase, which would be the smallest tuition increase since 1999. Tuition increase would raise $73 million over the 2 years for the colleges and universities. But in addition, the system, and this is lifting up from all of our colleges and universities in NINSU, would be redirecting $25 million in existing resources to support the initiative. So we are and do work very, very hard to look at ways we can save money, programs that maybe are not in demand and switching to others that are. We partner in terms of trying to find efficiencies in buying together and things like that. So we are very lean and mean, though, I will say that. But we are trying to do our share of helping save dollars also.
I hate to draw this good discussion to an end. I appreciate our panelists so much and the time that you took to come out on a cold evening to join us here. I need to mention that we have a letter that was received from a gentleman by the name of Dana Bacon from Egan, who is urging us to also consider increasing funds for physical education so that we can get a better handle on health care for children through wellness. And so we will read this letter into the record. With that, I am so deeply appreciative to this school and to the school district that is hosting, and I am going to adjourn the meeting.